You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of November 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tyler Brûlé. Coming up over the next 60 minutes, Hamas up the ante by firing a rocket directly at Jerusalem. We assess the impact of this and Israel's reaction. We have journalists on standby across the Middle East for the latest from the region.
Most people on the ground are understandably tense about where this is going to escalate to, and there are a number of rumors of a possible Israeli ground invasion into the Gaza Strip, as well as continued Hamas rockets pounding Israeli cities like Tel Aviv and Jerusalem.
And after the new Politburo Standing Committee is revealed, we do a who's who in China's new leadership team.
It's likely that we're not going to see any dramatic reform because the conservative forces are quite strong within this group. However, I think that the reformist voices are there and will be able to make themselves heard.
And at a time where religious differences underscore brutal conflict and human loss in the world, we speak to author Brian Leiter about his new book, Why Tolerate Religion. And of course, it's Friday. That means it's time for a week in review. Our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, and our editor, Andrew Tucker, here. Steve, what made news for you this week?
I'm going to talk about Tampa. Who knew? Who knew that Tampa was this hotbed of intrigue? But there'll be some serious things as well, won't there, Andrew?
Andrew?
I'm going to be looking at that Gaza story and just looking at how the new diplomatic ties are playing out in the region.
Great. Well, lots more to come over the next hour here on Midori House, live from London. And good evening from Midori House Studio One here in London. A lot to get through over the next 59 minutes here on Midori House. First, the news with Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. Hamas militants have launched a rocket on Jerusalem. It's the first time the city's been targeted from Gaza. Israeli Army Radio says the long-range missile landed just outside Jerusalem. No casualties have been reported. An earlier missile was aimed at Tel Aviv, but it fell into the sea. The attack comes as violence increases following Israel's killing of Hamas's military chief on Wednesday. Egypt's president, Mohamed Morsi, says he's backing Gaza in the face of what he calls blatant aggression. US State Department spokesman Mark Toner says Egypt has an important role to play in any peace negotiations.
Both we and the Egyptians agree there needs to be a de-escalation, and we urged the government of Egypt to take steps to support that kind of de-escalation using their influence in the region. But we want to see, obviously, a de-escalation of the violence. We need to see the violence to stop. We need to see Hamas stop its rocket attacks on Israel so we can end the violence.
Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague has had talks with Syrian opposition leaders. Mr. Hague has said he believes opposition groups could be a credible political alternative to the government of President Assad. At a press conference after their meeting, he said the UK needs more details before formally recognising the new coalition. But he welcomed it as an encouraging development.
I hope that today, this meeting today, will mark a turning point for the Syrian people and that it will begin the major steps towards a political transition in Syria. So I'm encouraged by what I've heard and seen from the leaders of the coalition, and I hope the discussions in London today will bring greater assistance to tens of thousands of people suffering today in Syria.
A Syrian general and 12 other officers have defected with their families to Turkey. The state-run news agency says it follows heavy fighting on Turkey's southeastern border with Syria. Ankara says it's intensified talks with its NATO allies to increase security along the 560-mile border. British police have arrested a suspected member of the Basque separatist group ETA in the northern city of Liverpool. Spain's Interior Ministry says he's 46-year-old Raul Sanchez Fuentes Viota and is linked to a series of murders. He's been on the run since 1995 and living in Britain using false documents. Japan's Prime Minister Yoshihiko Noda has dissolved Parliament in preparation for a general election next month. Mr. Noda, who's been in power since August 2011, will face the newly elected opposition leader Shinzo Abe in the polls. An appeals court in The Hague has overturned the conviction of the most senior Croatian military officer charged with war crimes during the Balkan conflict of the 1990s. Ante Gotovina, who was commander in the split district of the Croatian army, had been jailed for 24 years. The conviction of Mladen Markac, a police commander who'd been serving an 18-year sentence, was also overturned. IKEA says it deeply regrets the use of forced prison labour by its suppliers in communist East Germany more than two decades ago. The Swedish furniture company has apologised after the results were published of a report it commissioned into claims political prisoners worked in factories making its products in the 1960s and 70s. The company says it's never condoned the use of forced labour, but the report shows it failed to adequately vet the way its suppliers operated. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Bill. In a moment, we're going to be crossing over to Tel Aviv, Cairo, Jerusalem, and Beirut. Before that, though, it's 19:05 in Madrid, 18:05 in London. It's 13:05 in New York. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London,
London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle, vada se ti cheche.
From London,
London,
London, cara.
De Long, De Long.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. At least 23 Palestinians and three Israelis have been killed since Israel assassinated Hamas's military chief on Wednesday. In dramatic events today, Hamas militants have fired a rocket at Jerusalem, thought to be the first time the city has been targeted from Gaza. What Israel plans next and how far the ripples of the recriminations will be felt remains to be seen. Tonight, we have journalists standing by in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Cairo, and Beirut. We start in Jerusalem with our man on the ground there, Joseph Dana. Hello, Joseph.
Good evening, Tyler.
Just bring us up to speed right now, the feeling of the mood there and also what you're also hearing from other media outlets.
Well, the feeling is understandably very tense. It's Shabbat, it's the Sabbath this evening, and so there are not that many people on the streets of Jerusalem, but you can definitely feel an incredibly tense air due to the fact that the city, an Israeli settlement in the West Bank was hit by a rocket fired from Gaza this evening. And so just before we went live right now, there was news coming across the wires that Israel is looking to call up about 75,000 Israeli army reservists for a possible ground invasion inside of Gaza. And so this is a very dramatic escalation if indeed a ground invasion is to take place. And so this is adding to this very, very tense feeling on the ground.
What type of civil defense measures have been enacted, just given where rockets are falling at the moment? Is Israel on a special footing, or certainly cities that are in, of course, the line of fire? Have they moved to an added more advanced stage of civil defense measures?
Well, cities that are in the line of fire directly in the south definitely have a much more advanced kind of protections than cities like Jerusalem that are not accustomed to this type of rocket fire. Now, air raid sirens, you know, kind of wailed through the streets of Jerusalem in a very kind of alarming sign that something was, you know, possibly going to land somewhere around the center of the city. And a lot of people in Jerusalem didn't really know exactly what to do because, you know, they're not accustomed to living under this type of rocket fire. Just earlier today, the mayor of Tel Aviv announced that Tel Aviv is going to be opening its public bomb shelters, really for the first time since at least the 2006 war, but really since the Iraq war back in the 90s. And so these, you know, center cities inside of Israel are all of a sudden waking up to the realization that this is an incredibly serious conflict and that, you know, Hamas now has the capability to fire rockets really any corner of the country, and this is the new reality.
Joseph Dana in Jerusalem. Stay in touch in case anything develops while we're on air. We're now going over to Tel Aviv. Ben Hartman of the Jerusalem Post is on the line. Hello, Ben. I'm wondering if the feeling in Tel Aviv is really sort of echoing what we heard from Joseph Dana just now.
Yes and no. People responded with a good deal of surprise last night to the strikes that were here as well as today. But for the most part, if you did not hear the siren go off today, you wouldn't really be able to tell that there was something out of the ordinary in the city. Things appear for the most part to be just a normal Friday in Tel Aviv. The cafes, the bars still have people sitting in them, even though the police beefed up their patrols, doubled, they say, the number of people patrolling in the Yarkon sub-district. You really don't see a massive police presence or border patrolman presence, and it really appears to be basically the normal Tel Aviv we're used to. It had the potential, I think, to get into some sort of panic or hysterical sort of situation if this continues or really picks up to a certain degree, because in Tel Aviv people lack protection, like Joseph was saying, in Jerusalem as well. Tel Aviv is not used to rockets on a regular basis, not since the Gulf War in 91. And most of the buildings were built long before that. And there's laws that have gone in since then. I mean, any new buildings have to have safe rooms and shelters built in them. But all those built before, which is the majority of the construction in Tel Aviv, does not have these bomb shelters. So this is it's kind of a little bit of a return to the past, something that hasn't been in Tel Aviv in a long time, but potentially be quite dangerous to people, because unlike the places in the south, which get these rockets much more often on a regular basis, in Tel Aviv, people don't have as much bomb shelters and protection as they do down there.
Mm. What happens from a national psyche point of view in Israel if we're indeed looking at having, you know, anywhere up to 70,000, 75,000 reservists mobilized?
Right. Well, the government allowing, you know, up to that number, it's hard to say how many will actually be deployed. The defensive shield had around 20,000 or so, give or take. Regardless, it would have a strong effect potentially on the national psyche, because the Israeli public has a very emotional connection to its soldiers, to the army. If there's 75,000 people called up for the reserve, there's not going to be a single Israeli family that either doesn't have one of its own members or doesn't know somebody very close who does. So it's going to have a strong effect on the national psyche, just because of the very intimate and emotional connection people have here with the army, because of the draft and because of the country's history. So, anytime that, you know, it sounds maybe a bit opposite or a bit backwards to people outside of Israel, but there's often a worse or more severe reaction here when it's soldiers that are hurt or soldiers that are in the line of fire, as opposed to civilians, which may sound a bit ironic, but you know, as terrible as the events were the other day in Kiryat Malachi, when the three people were killed in the house in the rocket strike, when there will be great trauma if there's a military funeral with you know, three dead soldiers. I mean, this is very traumatic for Israelis when things happen to soldiers, and also, you know, if there's 75,000, that's going to be a lot of people's families. Most families in Israel will know somebody.
Ben Hartman of the Jerusalem Post in Tel Aviv. Thank you very much for that. Now, the role of Egypt and what it's playing on the diplomatic side. We are going to be joined now by going over to Cairo, to Abdelrahman Hussein. Just a little bit on Prime Minister Hisham Kandil's visit. How is this playing out across the Egyptian and Arab networks right now, Mr. Hussein?
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood presidency has to cater to its own backyard, and there's a lot of people. Obviously, the Palestinian cause is a cause that is very close to many, many people in Egypt, whether they're from Islamist forces or secular forces. So, but the President Morsi is trying to appear to be doing a lot more than his predecessor Hosni Mubarak did during Operation Cast Lead in 2008, Prime Minister Andil's visit to Gaza today is part of that sort of PR drive to show that this time it's different. This time Egypt will be standing with the people of Gaza, and they will not let them be bombed by the Israeli offensive, just like Mubarak did in 2008. So there's a comparison at play here between what Mubarak did in 2008 and what Morsi is doing now.
Mm. Just the PM's visit, how much of that is a domestic play? Giving some sense of a new type of command role within the borders of Egypt. But how much of is it also a regional play and a display to other Arab states?
Well, of course it is a regional play, but we can't dismiss the longstanding ties between Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas is originally an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, so the ties are there. On the regional level, definitely Egypt wants to come center stage on this issue, but we also have to bear in mind that Gaza is on the border with Egypt. It shares a border with Sinai, and so at heart, this is a domestic issue more than it would be a regional issue.
Thank you very much for that. That's Abdulrahman Hussein in Cairo. We're now jumping north, going up to Beirut. Abigail Fielding-Smith of the Financial Times is on the line. Good evening, Abigail.
Good evening.
When you get north of the border now, and quite literally the sandwich that Lebanon sits in and so often sits in within the region, how is this being received? And particularly when you sort of look at also the very sort of partisan nature of just the Lebanese TV channels as well.
No, you're right. I mean, partisan is exactly the right word. What's been interesting in the reaction here is how much it has played into debates about the conflict next door in Syria. So Lebanon at the moment is very deeply divided between one faction, which is sort of allied to the regime, and the other, which is supporting the opposition. And we've seen that in the way that people have reacted to the Gaza events. Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, has said that, you know, Israel is using the turmoil in Syria as an opportunity to strike the Gazans, whereas the other side, Saad Hariri, the sort of main leader of the opposition, predominantly Sunni party, has said that, you know, the opposite, that Israel is actually, that this is actually, I mean, he's come to the same conclusion for a different reason, basically. Saying that Israel wants to keep the regime in power in Syria, implying that, and that therefore they're kind of doing this to stop there being momentum for the Syrian uprising. It's definitely kind of highlighted the divisions over Syria.
Before we go, are there any rumblings from the south? And, you know, oftentimes, again, you go back to the various Lebanese and Arabic news outlets, any massing of media along the border in case of any flare-up right now? Or is that where you're seeing the Lebanese networks reporting from the south?
I mean, I think at the moment, most people's assumption is like in 2008, in fact. Hezbollah, you know, will want to support Hamas at the level of rhetoric, but will be very reluctant to actually embroil themselves in a conflict with Israel. It doesn't feel like that the place is anticipating having to cut, you know, a massive Hezbollah action on Israel at the moment. Obviously, if the situation in Gaza escalates, pressure on Hezbollah to at least be seen to be doing something will increase. So maybe the atmosphere here will be changed if this goes on much longer. But at the moment, I think, you know, based on what Nasrallah has been saying so far in his speeches and how they behaved last time, I don't think there's a kind of febrile anticipation of something happening on the southern border here at the moment.
Abigail Fielding-Smith, I'm going to leave you to hopefully enjoy your Friday night in Beirut. You're listening to Midori House. In a moment, we'll find out who's who in the seven new members of China's Politburo Standing Committee. Stay with us.
The latest culinary trends, restaurants with the best food, the coziest cafes, and the makers behind them. The menu tells you all you need to know about the world of cuisine and drinks, and the people who are doing things differently.
The end is very important, just as in a sad ending, you may feel sort of sad in a play. No, there's no such thing as a sad ending for a meal, but there is the idea of a resounding ending, like the coda of a last movement of a symphony.
From organic cuisine in Sao Paulo to the latest coffee trends in Helsinki, from the most adventurous speakeasy in New York to the best butchers in Sydney, tune in on Fridays at 1900 hours London time or download the shows from Monocle's website.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug. Nestled into the urban fabric of London, Hong Kong, New York and Tokyo, Monocle shops are small, cosy outposts of everything we care about. That's incredible design, credible provenance, charming service and, of course, intelligent journalism. Stock up on the latest issue of the magazine, browse our carefully curated selection of books and music, or seek out your favourite back issue to fill that gap in your Monocle archive. So drop in to one of our shops and our friendly staff will be on hand to show you around. For addresses and opening hours, visit monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is 2020 in Helsinki, 1820 in London, and it is 1220 if you're listening in Chicago. Well, as expected, the 18th Congress of the Chinese Communist Party culminated with the anointment of Xi Jinping as the paramount leader of the People's Republic. After some speculation, how Xi will rule the party has become more clear since his acceptance speech, the tone combative, conservative, steeped in communist rhetoric. None of that so surprising. Yet the slimmed-down seven-man Politburo Standing Committee combines members that exemplify both reformist and conservative ideologies. Raffaello Pantucci, visiting scholar at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences, profiles the other six members.
So starting with Li Keqiang, he is the number two in the new Politburo. He is seen as a more reformist character. He's very close to Hu Jintao. He comes from Anhui province, which is traditionally a very poor province. And then he went from there and studied at Tsinghua University in Beijing, which is a very prestigious university. And from there, he's sort of risen up the party ranks. And he's seen as a more reformist character. He's one of the sort of younger figures within the new Politburo. And him and Xi Jinping are the two who will definitely go into the next administration. All the other five are older and will have to retire. So that's Li Keqiang. Next along is Mr. Zhang Dejiang, who is the sort of number three. He is seen as one of the sort of princeling factions that a lot is said about. He's actually very interesting. He was a North Korean-trained economist. He went to Kim Il-sung University. His father was also seen as a protege of Jiang Zemin. So he is very much part of this group of people who are seen as Jiang Zemin, who is the former leader before Hu Jintao's sort of people. He was he's quite interesting from the perspective of he was sent to Chongqing after Bo Xilai was ejected from power. And he was sort of sent in to try to tidy up the mess. And during that time there, he started to dismiss a lot of these myths that had started to grow up around Bo Xilai. He's seen as a very sort of conservative figure. Next along, we have Mr. Yu Zhengsheng, who is the former Shanghai party chief. He is another one of this sort of princeling faction. His family heritage is very good. They were very close to Deng Xiaoping, who is the famous Chinese leader who opened up the country. He's a military engineer by training, but in his time, he's been known as being quite good at helping advance Chinese companies going abroad, and he specifically helped hire and Qingdao Beer. He's also seen as very close to the sort of Jiang Zemin faction, and he was a former minister of construction. Next along, we have Mr. Liu Yunshan, who is seen as closer to Hu Jintao. He comes from Hu Jintao's faction, come from a group that he used to run called the Chinese Communist Youth League. And Liu Yunshan was a deputy head of this in Inner Mongolia as a younger man. He was then a Xinhua reporter, so a state reporter, and he's now risen up to be the sort of chief propaganda man. He's said to be very concerned about the sort of burgeoning, Weibo and social media that we see in China, but he's going to be the man who controls sort of all the propaganda side of things. Next along, we have Mr. Wang Qishan, who is probably one of the members of the Politburo who's actually known to the outside world already. He's a former quite senior figure within the Politburo before. He was mayor of Beijing for a while during the SARS epidemic and was seen as very good in handling that crisis. He's seen as very close to former Prime Minister Zhu Rongji, who is very famous for his economic reforms. And Wang Qishan is seen as a very reformist figure. He worked in the past. He was a banker. He joined the Communist Party quite late at age 35. And he is seen as one of the sort of few reforming figures within the new Politburo. He is also, his job within the Politburo is as the head of the sort of anti-graft group. So he's going to be responsible theoretically for rooting out lots of corruption within the party. And then the final figure is Mr. Zhang Gaoli, who is the former Tianjin party chief. Zhang Gaoli, there is a lot less is known about him personally. He is known to be quite close to Jiang Zemin, and he previously worked in the oil industry. But then he was vice governor and then secretary of Shenzhen. He was vice governor in Guangdong, which is the province down south, where a lot of the sort of reforms, the economic reforms started. And he was in charge of Shenzhen when, from 97 to 2001, which is when the city was really opening up. So, you know, he may have some economic free spirit within him. However, he's very much seen as part of the sort of conservative Jiang Zemin faction. There's one big discussion which has been made of this new sort of Politburo makeup, and the whole discussion is about the conservatives versus the reformists. This group is seen very much of the sort of conservative bent. And of course, that means that we're likely to have a more conservative approach to economic reform over the next period. Having said that, the figures who are reformists within it are seen as the leaders, the ones who are going to survive until the next administration, and also Wang Qishan, who is very famous for being a very dogged representative for sort of reformist ideas. So I think it's likely that we're not going to see any dramatic reform because the conservative forces are quite strong within this group. However, I think that the reformist voices are there and will be able to make themselves heard. And I think more importantly, this means that coming up to the next administration in 5 years when it changes over again, the new people who come in will be more likely to pick up these reformist ideas and take them further forwards.
And that was Raffaello Pantucci, visiting scholar at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences. I'm now joined in the studio by our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, who's also going to be back a little bit later as well with our week in review. You can just, you know, you can keep that chair.
I could,
you know,
just stay here.
You can keep it working. Now, I thought we were going to play a game. I have some flashcards here in front of me, and these are just photographs of course, the new leadership. And I'm going to ask you to match the names with the photos. How does that sound? Are you ready for it?
Okay, I can do that. I can do that.
Okay, who's this?
Well, that's easy. Okay. That's Xi Jinping.
Okay. This one. Who's this one?
That, I think, is Li Keqiang.
Not bad.
Ah. See, I'm not bad at this.
Okay, and one more. Who's this?
Zhang Gaoli.
Oh, God damn. I've
been learning. I've been reading up.
We thought we'd have you stumped. That is amazing.
I have one serious point to make.
Please.
And that's that we should not forget that China is not the only country in that region which is going through a leadership change at the moment. We're going to have elections in Japan. We've got elections coming up in Korea. And it's how those leadership changes occur and the personalities of those leaders that come into office is going to be really fascinating. And there's a whole range of different issues from the Senkaku or Diaoyu Islands to how we deal with North Korea to all sorts of other things with the South China Sea, which are going to be really crucial over the coming years. And the identity of those leaders will be the most important thing.
I'm actually surprised that we haven't heard this great sigh of relief, you know, from all over China and the region, because it's incredible. It felt like so many things over the last probably 5 or 6 weeks really ground to a halt because everyone had to wait to see what was going to happen in Beijing. You know, largely we knew it was going to happen, but just purely from an appearances perspective, we were talking to both Liv in Hong Kong and our bureau chief Fiona Wilson in Tokyo, just saying, you know, just the mere fact that, you know, even if people really loved, you know, Japan, if you're a business person, Taipei, Hong Kong, you know, not even, you know, part of, you know, China per se, you just couldn't get on a plane. You couldn't go and do business. So you wonder how much is going to be business as usual. People see reformists in there. Do they think, okay, you know what, we've got a green light now?
It may not have been an election, but the build-up to it was very similar to an election campaign in that there was rhetoric was increased. People said things that they thought would appeal to the electorate, in this case, senior members of the Politburo and the people behind the Politburo. So I think it's certainly possible that rhetoric will be toned down a little bit more, that now Xi Jinping is in power, that he knows which allies he's got, which ones he doesn't, who's there around him. He might feel a little bit more comfortable about some of the broader issues and may not have to be quite so nationalistic. It remains to be seen, though.
And you have to sort of wonder also what type of, not so much PR offensive, but you know, how busy those Air China planes are going to be at the moment, getting these new Politburo members, you know, out there in the world. And of course, you know, many of them, you know, have held positions, you know, which would certainly take them across borders representing the country. But, you know, it's a new portfolio now. And then how much they have to be, you know, seen to be representing the nation and, you know, a little bit of fence manning to be done here and there?
A little bit, yes. I think the more important thing will be them getting on those Air China planes and going around China and getting out to other major cities in China and hearing what other local leaders have concerns about. I think that's going to be more pressing for them initially rather than what happens outside their borders.
Mm, better them on Air China than you and me, Steve Bloomfield. We will see you back here in a moment. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And in the next half hour of the program, our news editor Tom Edwards chats with the author Brian Leiter about his new book, Why Tolerate Religion? And we review the week with some of our editors, Steve Bloomfield, just heard from there, of course, at the top of the show as well. They'll be here in the studio. Plus, we'll take a trip around the neighborhood of our Hong Kong bureau and check out Derek Leung's new menswear shop.
So in here we have Arts and Science. This brand is also one of my favorite. It's just so clean and simple, the style.
I like a bit of arts and science as well. That's part of our regular Meet the Neighbor segment. Of course, we're venturing a little bit further abroad. We've kind of exhausted the neighborhood in and around Midori House. It is the bottom of the hour. It's 31 minutes past time for Bill Bingham with the hours, or bottom of the hour headlines.
Hamas militants have launched a rocket on Jerusalem. It's the first time the city's been targeted from Gaza. Israeli Army Radio says the long-range missile landed just outside Jerusalem. No casualties have been reported. An early missile was aimed at Tel Aviv, but it fell into the sea. The attack comes as violence increases following Israel's killing of Hamas's military chief on Wednesday. Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague has had talks with Syrian opposition leaders. Mr. Hague has said he believes opposition groups could be a credible political alternative to the government of President Assad. A Syrian general and 12 other officers have defected with their families to Turkey. The state-run news agency says it follows heavy fighting on Turkey's southeastern border with Syria. British police have arrested a suspected member of the Basque separatist group ETA in the northern city of Liverpool. Spain's interior ministry says he's 46-year-old Raul Sanchez Fuentes Viota and is linked to a series of murders. Japan's Prime Minister Yoshihiko Noda has dissolved Parliament in preparation for a general election next month. Mr. Noda, who's been in power since August 2011, will face the newly elected opposition leader Shinzo Abe in the polls. An appeals court in The Hague has overturned the conviction of the most senior Croatian military officer charged with war crimes during the Balkan conflict of the 1990s. Ante Gotovina, who was commander in the split district of the Croatian army, had been jailed for 24 years. And those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Bill Bingham. More from you in about 28, almost 27 minutes time. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, here's a question to get your brain working and a bit of a debate raging on a Friday evening or even Friday afternoon, even Friday morning if you're listening in Honolulu. Why tolerate religion? It's one of the most enduring puzzles in politics and philosophy. Why does religion receive preferential treatment in law and public discourse? Well, someone who is seeking to explore the complexities of that question is Brian Leiter, professor of jurisprudence and director of the Center of Law, Philosophy and Human Values at the University of Chicago. His new book, Why Tolerate Religion, is an essay that attempts to, of course, get to the core of the question with an engaging mixture of legal insight and wry wit to shed some light on the issue. Our Tom Edwards, who is our news editor, talked to him a little bit earlier today and asked him to explain why he chose to tackle this divisive and controversial subject.
No, it actually hadn't. What got me interested in it is I lived in the state of Texas for many years, and as your listeners may know, Texas is a fairly religious and conservative state in the United States. And I began to think about this when I saw the ways in which, for example, conservative Christian groups tried to influence the teaching of science in the public schools, really to undermine the teaching of biology in particular, by introducing creationism and intelligent design and suggesting that Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection might not be true, and so on. That's what initially led to my interest in it. But then as I began to look into it, the first thing that struck me is in all the Western democracies, people can get exemptions from a law that would otherwise apply to them if they say, my religion, as a matter of conscience, requires me not to do this. someone who's not religious can't get those kinds of exemptions. But non-religious people have conscience too, right? We all have a sense of what's right and wrong, what we must do or must not do. But those claims of conscience turn out to have no legal standing, either in practice, nowhere. Some of the European constitutions do actually mention liberty of conscience. The United States doesn't even mention it. It's strictly freedom of religion. And so the question was, why should only religious people have a claim of conscience to say, I can't do this even though the law requires it? Why only do the religious get that privilege? That was the question that animated the book. And the conclusion I reached was there's no good reason to think that only religious claims of conscience are legally special.
So we'll come on to that issue of, about the sort of distinctions in different forms of conscience in a moment. And I know you give some interesting examples in the book, but just in terms of your sort of mindset at the outset of this process then, is it fair to say you were cynical about religion, or were you just rather more concerned with that seeming hypocrisy, if you like, between, yeah, religion on the one hand and other forms of established behavior on the other?
It's fair to say when I started writing the book, when I first wrote an essay with this title, Why Tolerate Religion, I was so annoyed with what the conservative Christians were doing in Texas that I wanted to come up with the answer, no, we don't need to tolerate that kind of religion. But as I worked on it, I came to the conclusion that's wrong, that there are good reasons to tolerate religion, but they're not specific to religion. What there are reasons to tolerate liberty of conscience, that it's central to democratic societies that individuals have some sphere in which they can act on their conscientious sense of what's right and wrong, what they must do, what they must not do, and so on. And that encompasses those whose conscience is informed by religion, but it also encompasses those who have no religious beliefs. I have no religious beliefs, but also have a sense of right and wrong, as I think we all do.
And just touching then upon this idea of conscience, I mean, you mentioned in the book some examples, I guess you could call it sort of a misguided conscience, if you like. You cite some obviously fairly emotive examples, you know, looking back to the Second World War, for example, Nazi Germany, people who can be acting in a sense, you know, according to their conscience, in inverted commas. How difficult is it to, when you set out on a project like this, to sort of unpick these kind of almost paradoxes about what it is to be an issue of conscience?
Well, certainly one of the aims in any kind of philosophical investigation is to try to get clear about what we're talking about. And one question is, what are we talking about when we talk about conscience? I think the basic idea with conscience is that it's a sense of, I call it categoricity, which is a fancy word for saying our sense of the things we must and must not do, non-negotiable things, right? Lots of things are negotiable. I could have Chinese food tonight or not. That's negotiable. But some things aren't negotiable. And it's, of course, characteristic of all religions that they make categorical demands on their adherents. Certain things you can do, certain things you can't do, no matter what. The problem, of course, with conscience is that some people have a conscience, but it's a depraved conscience. And that was the example I give of many of the officials in Nazi Germany. They actually thought about what they were doing in very moralistic terms. Right? They thought they were doing something morally important that was obligatory, that was right, and so on. They used all the language we would use, but they applied it to actions that, of course, were abhorrent. So people's sense of conscience can be very, very distorted. The fact that someone acts conscientiously doesn't mean they actually do the right thing.
Now, another interesting point which I found, I mean, again, I guess some people would perhaps say that this is almost a semantic point, but it's to look at tolerance itself. I mean, the title is Why Tolerate Religion? Tolerance is always bandied around as something, you know, a great virtue, particularly in Western liberal democracies. You know, tolerance is something we should all aspire to. But there can be something more sort of insidious and almost dangerous about this, certainly on a philosophical level. How much of a battle do you think we face, certainly in Western democracies, at addressing this idea that actually being tolerant without question can be almost as damaging as being intolerant?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, the basic idea of toleration is one group tolerates another when they disapprove of what that group does or what they believe, but they say, you know what, they have a right to do it anyway. And the thing that's a little offensive about toleration, right, is sometimes you don't want to be tolerated. You don't want to have the sense that one group thinks what you're doing or what you believe is wrong. You want to be accepted. You want to be perhaps even respected. But that's a demand that's a very hard demand to satisfy. The fact is, in modern societies with many different religious groups, with non-religious believers, different political affiliations, ethnic and cultural traditions, many groups look at other groups and they say, boy, do they have it wrong. What we need to have a functioning democratic society is a regime of tolerance where we say, look, even though we don't like it, people are allowed to believe and feel differently than we do. And that was the great lesson from the, you know, early modern Europe and the horrendous wars of religion. People realized that we're going to be a lot better off if we just say live and let live to some extent, rather than try to convert everyone to our way of thinking. So in that sense, tolerance is still very important, even though the groups who are tolerated may sometimes bristle a bit at the thought that others have to tolerate them.
And that leads me on to an interesting point about the sort of reaction to the book responses and what you hope that will be. I just wondered, did you have any concerns writing the essay that, as you said, I mean, particularly you think of, say, you know, yeah, we have some states in the US where they seem to be rather less flexible about looking at these kind of issues. Do you ever have any concerns that people will misconstrue your attempts to fathom this on a philosophical level as being anti-religious? Is that something that ever concerns you?
Yeah. Look, there's certainly a risk of that. And I do say things in the book that I think some very sincere religious believers will find a bit offensive. Though in the end, I argue for toleration of religion, but I don't argue that the reasons for toleration are specific to religion. But that view in itself, of course, may strike some religious believers as offensive. That is the nature of intellectual inquiry. We have to, as it were, push the limits. The truth is, if you look at the European Convention on Human Rights, it specifically mentions liberty of conscience in addition to religious liberty. The puzzle is why in countries in Europe where liberty of conscience is specifically mentioned in the law, it doesn't actually show up in the courts. That is, the people who get the exemptions are almost without exception religious believers. So in some sense, I hope this book is a wake-up call to actually live up to the ideal of liberty of conscience, which is, again, one of the central ideals that, you know, was bequeathed us by the Enlightenment. But so far, it's primarily recognized in the legal realm only for religious believers. And that strikes me as fundamentally unfair.
And that was our Tom Edwards speaking to Brian Leiter about his new book, Why Tolerate Religion. Run out and buy it for a bit of weekend reading. You're listening to Midori House in a moment. We'll be back with some music. No, actually, we're not going to do any songs because I'm going to be joined by two of my favorite editors. We're going to be talking about the Week in Review. Back after this.
Be our guest and come spend the weekend with Monocle 24. We kick off on Saturday with the Weekend Edition, a smart, relaxing selection of music, news headlines and great conversation.
There's real excitement there, you know, and it's sort of like, wow, I don't really understand what they're doing, but I love the sound of it.
Then join us for our brand new show, The Stack, celebrating the world of print media, from chunky Korean glossies to fine-tuned Brazilian newspapers. Hosted by Tyler Brulé, each week we pull in guest reviewers to crack open spines and thumb through inky pages to reveal why there's more to journalism than going digital.
The publication you have in your hand is all about women across the Middle East. The one in your hand is about skiing in Morocco. They have one about the Saudi pavilion in the Osaka Expo. So it was very progressive.
Later, this Saturday review casts a critical eye over the week's literature, music, TV, cinema and the arts and delivers some fun, fast-paced conversation too.
It's a bit of a riot, actually. They just boiled the crayfish in water.
That sounds like a riot so far.
On Sunday, stay over for the Monocle Weekly, our longest-running radio show that brings our editors face-to-face with everyone from academics to war correspondents, historians to social commentators, and serves up some fine music too.
I sort of came to Brazilian music quite late. Yeah, it's something that I'm still discovering.
And don't miss The Curator, our one-hour survey of the week's highlights on Monocle 24. That's the new weekend lineup on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House, 1844 in London, 1344 in New York. Is that the world's longest sting ever? Not staying, longest promo for the weekend. I mean, it was like the whole weekend, all like 48 hours of it.
But I know, but at least now I know what I'm going to do at the weekend.
Me too.
And it does include your stack program. That's probably why I was being dragged
Thank
out.
Did they promote it? I missed that. I don't think they did, because we've got our own dedicated promo.
I think you've got several of them, actually.
Not like your show. Where's your show, Steve? We thought we were going to have a program, a foreign affairs program, this time. You know, 1 year on.
So did I.
I know.
It's my fault.
What are you doing?
You're the editor in chief.
Yeah, I know, but I've got to find sponsors for my own program. Anyway, you get out there. Okay, gentlemen, week in review. We're covering at the top of the program, everything that's been unfolding in Israel and Gaza at the moment. Is it Petraeus or Beijing?
Well, let's start with Gaza. I think what's fascinating about Gaza, there's two really interesting things being played out here for me. The first is that the technology game, because what's interesting is we know that the Israelis have, you know, the shield, they have incredible drones, etc., etc. But the other side is getting a kind of transfer of technology that we haven't seen before. They now have missiles that can go 40 miles and hit Jerusalem. They've successfully hit Tel Aviv twice. Now, whether that information to build those rockets better is coming from Iran, we don't know. But it's certainly an upping of the game. So I think there's a technology story that's really interesting. And the other thing is the tugging of old diplomatic ties. They're not pulling in the way that they used to. So Israel isn't quite sure what Egypt will do. The Palestinians must be surprised that they have, you know, an Egyptian delegation flying in straight away and kind of big support. The Americans are probably a bit uneasy. They're just easing into the new administration. They were hoping things would be a little bit quieter in the region. There's a lot of things going on there that people are not quite sure what the consequences of actions will be.
Steve, do you think there's probably some stern words or at least some firm discussions going on amongst various security officials? I would imagine, you know, not just, you know, the PM's office, but probably many ministries talking to, you know, Mossad, wondering, you know, how did these missiles, get into the country? I mean, they probably have, you know, a general idea, but nevertheless, you know, this is something which, you know, security services are supposed to, you know, knock these things on the head well before they get deployed.
Well, there is a sense that Israel has slightly taken its eye off the ball, both politically and clearly in an intelligence way, from the situation with Palestine, by focusing so strongly on Iran and the potential for a nuclear program there over the past 2 years, really. That's been the main thing. And what they've missed is an increasing sort of militantism within Gaza itself. Hamas has, on the whole, pretty strong support still in Gaza. And there was an assumption that, well, because the peace process is dead in the water, that everyone's kind of really forgotten about it and we can just carry on as it was before. And we can't. And I think, you know, there'll be a number of people, you know, within Israel wondering why no one really saw this coming, and wondering why. You know, it's all very well saying, well, Israel has a right to defend itself, and it does. But when it looks back at the last operation in Gaza, Operation Cast Lead in 2008, the war in Lebanon in 2006, you can say, yes, there were legitimate reasons why Israel did what it did. But when you look at it back, say, did it actually make Israel safer? And I don't think the answer to that is yes.
I wonder, gentlemen, should we head east and go to Beijing, or should we discuss things that happened up and down the North American coast?
Let's go to Beijing.
Let's go to Beijing. Steve, you've kind of done.
I've done Beijing.
Did you hear his quiz earlier?
I successfully named, from the photos that Tyler had in front of him, three of the leaders of the Politburo. Three out of three.
We did Flash Bureau. Flash Bureau.
Flash
Bureau. That's actually a good concept. We should open up Flash Bureaus around the world. Now we're here, now we're not.
We're not going to ask you to do the same.
No. Okay. It would be embarrassing.
What I think what is interesting is just this idea that you have, which I think is actually quite a good idea, oddly, despite it being a communist idea from China, is that you have this kind of clean out every 10 years. You kind of say, okay, all you lot off, next crew on. Mm. And also because of the aging of the kind of the two or three generations before this current leadership, you know, there's going to be a clean sweep soon. There's, you know, they're not going to be around. He's going to be able to kind of have a good kind of run at setting his own agenda.
That's true. He's right.
I think there's a bigger story to discuss, though, in all of this. We hear about this extraordinary luxury boom, the importance of China as a market, and of course the fortunes which are being made by the likes of a company like Zegna, for example. However, we scan our eyes across the Congress Party Hall, and it doesn't really look like any of the assembled members are spending a lot of money on sartorialism.
I had to work out the names of those gentlemen you showed me.
Not
based on their style. Nothing noticeable about their style.
Absolutely.
They all have the same suit, the same wine red tie, the same jet black hair, which is obviously entirely natural.
I was going to say, what is Zhang Goli wearing? Is that Brioni? Or is it something from the new Berluti collection? It'd be tricky, wouldn't it?
It would indeed.
But contacts are obviously in, because in the old days, they'd all have good specs, but there's very few good specs around.
And Zhang still has his specs.
Oh, does he?
When he sort of, reappeared last week as sort of the power behind the throne.
Do you reckon they're Tom Ford?
I'm not entirely sure they are.
No. I think probably Tom Ford is inspired by them.
That's quite possible.
Yeah. Well,
okay, let's go to Washington. Well, you.
Let's go to Tampa.
Well, yeah, so you want to go to Tampa? Okay. This is you teased all of our listeners at the top of the program. Let's start in Tampa.
I love this story. I absolutely love it. First of all, never using Gmail again. I mean, if even like the head of the CIA can get caught out on Gmail, the rest of us are in serious trouble. It's astonishing, frankly, that an affair with someone has not just brought down the director of the CIA. It's also cast all sorts of aspersions over General John Allen, who was supposed to be becoming the new NATO commander. And it just baffles me. And every day a story comes out which sort of takes it along a little bit more. Mm. Jill Kelly, fantastic character. You couldn't make her up. My favourite thing, I think, is that there's a story in the LA Times by Shashank Bengali where he realised he got the police records, where it revealed that she had apparently been made an honorary consul for South Korea. And once there was a journalist allegedly trespassing on her property. So she rang the police and said, I'm the honorary ambassador to South Korea. You need to sort this out. Perhaps you want to get diplomatic police involved.
Well, that's throwing it around. Andrew, in 15 seconds, your view.
Well, it's great that they all know how to dress for TV.
Oh, yes.
None of them have kind of rushed out the house too early in the morning. They've all chosen the right frock. They know what colour to look. It is amazing how American people caught up in any crisis, they know how to play it for the media.
Absolutely. Bare arms all around, especially on The Daily Show. Andrew Tuck and Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor, thanks very much for that. You are listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Op London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House on Monocle 24. Now it's time to meet the neighbours. Not in and around Marylebone, we're heading to Hong Kong. Derek Leung opened his menswear shop Del Store in the Star Street area of Wan Chai in September last year, located just around the corner from our own Monocle shop and bureau. He has become a welcome addition to our neighbourhood.
My name is Derek Leung. I open a store. It's called Del Store. It's in Wan Chai. Actually, I'm a co-founder, co-owner of this store. I actually am the more responsible for the buying and then the sourcing, the brand sourcing part. We try to bring in brands, product, items that we like, and then we hope the customer will appreciate our selection. I think, to be honest, I think it's we just happened to come up to this idea of opening up a store. It was a no plan project actually. So me and my business partner we met in Paris in a trade show, and then we talk a lot of nonsense stuff, and then so it come up
with this idea, hey, why don't we just open a store? And then just like that, then we open a store. The whole process was really quick. When it comes to brand selection, and we tend to introduce brands that are more focused on the workmanship and material. For example, we have Nigel Cabon. It's a UK brand. The designer is from Newcastle. He's been around for many years, and then all his life, you know, that he spent a lot of time and resources to collect the vintage items. So you seldom see people that are so devoted to their interests, you know. So the, so we really appreciate, you know, his effort to make the beautiful garments. And in here we have another brand called Tender, is from UK. So this is rather new collection to us, and this brand is I really like it because I seldom see a collection, a simple collection like this, that is more focused on the technique of material and also, you know, the color dyeing. And most of the items are using natural dyeing method. So in here we have Arts and Science. This brand is also one of my favorite. It's just so clean and simple, the style, but it's all about the fitting. So for example, you know, this four button jacket that we're looking at, you know, once you put it on, you can see, you know, that it just fits on your body so nice. And then the material they are using are always very, very special, that you don't see, you know, the usually, you know, the anywhere. We have a lot of Japanese brands. For example, we have Nanamika, we have Yaeka, and we have also the a lot of denim label from Okayama. Just I like beautifully made product. So that in here we have brands from UK, from US, from Japan. We hope in the near future we'll be able to introduce, you know, the brands from Italy and probably from France or from other part of Europe as well. We want to also expand our women's business as well, so that to do both men's and women's selection in one retail space.
And that was Derek Leung from Del Store, which is just around the corner from our bureau on St. Francis Yard in the Wan Chai district of Hong Kong. And this is, of course, around the corner from Star Street as well. And that was our regular Meet the Neighbor section, which we do every Friday here on Midori House. I think that almost brings us to the end of the program after a very, very busy week here at Midori House. Much coming up, though, later on this evening, of course. We have the Daily is going to be here with Andrew Muller and Dominic Reynolds looking after that program tonight. Of course, that hits airwaves at 2200 London time. And then, of course, there's a very busy weekend after that. I'm going to be back in about 15 hours from now. I'm going to be back with our weekly print review with The Stack. Of course, that is going to be followed by, of course, The Review, which comes on at midday London time. Usually looked after by Emma Nelson, Gillian DeBias, I can say, is part on assignment in Doha at the moment. Of course, film festival on there. And of course, then you can tune in to the show that kicked it all off. The Monocle Weekly is here at midday on Sunday. But for now, from all of us here in London, this program was produced by Ala John. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. But for now, for me, Tyler Brulé, it's goodbye from London.